Well, today I wanted to gear my sermon toward those that are younger. Now that I'm older, younger is a relative term, but say 30 years of age and younger. And I'm hoping that the rest of us, as we go through here, are able to glean something from the message. But, you know, to those of us that are older, those of us that grew up during the days of the Worldwide Church of God, we were exposed to different topics that today we don't cover as much anymore. One of those topics was the end times. You know, and I'll be the first to admit that back in the day, in those days, the 70s, the 80s, you find that the church had a tendency to go overboard in what we taught. You know, there were things that were more conjecture than fact. And then they built upon this conjecture. And it made the story more exciting. But there were times when we were flat out wrong. You know, they said the Christ was going to return in 1972. You know, that's many, many years ago. You know, and I think that many have struggled over the years with that, with this stigma of failed projections. People put these things out there and they don't come to pass. And then after the breakup, the Worldwide Church of God, what you found is the churches were very careful in what they taught. Because you didn't want to be putting anything out there that you couldn't prove as being true. And so what you found is we were often so very careful with all that we ended up in the opposite ditch. We didn't say anything about it at all. So when we began talking about the end times, those of us that are older, those of us that grew up around all this, we have this reservoir of knowledge that then we can, these experiences that we draw on, and these things kind of come back to us, to our remembrance. It's a review for us. However, for those that are younger, it's a totally different experience. And when we talk about the end times, it's a lot harder to wrap your minds around what's going on. And I know lately, probably the past year or so, I've been making statements that said, I believe that we are living in the time of the end. I still believe that. It's kind of interesting. I grew up under that cloud. That cloud that says we're living in the end time. I mean, even as a school-age child, when I was growing up, I'd hear things, similar to, people would tell you, you're never going to graduate high school because the end is going to come. You'll never experience college. You'll never have to worry about getting a job or getting married or having kids because the end is going to come. I was told that from the pulpit growing up. Look at me. I'm now 58 years old. I did graduate from high school and college. I got married. I worked for almost 30 years in the computer field. Had 4 kids. They're mostly gone now. But now I have grandkids. I have a grandson that has a birthday today. You know, the end never came through all of that. And here I am. And yet, I'm still saying I believe that we are living in the time of the end. Am I a nut? I mean, is that crazy? Perhaps I've been brainwashed. That's the only thing I know how to say because that's the only thing that I've heard all of my life. So how can I be confident in saying to you that I believe we're living in the time of the end? For those of you that never had this idea beat into your head, how can I convince you that we are living in the time of the end? Now, why do we talk about watching and praying? We heard the sermonette on prayer. Thought that was an interesting take on it. I appreciate that. You know, why do we talk about the demise of this country? Why do we talk about what's going on in Europe or Israel? Why do we talk about the Catholic Church or the Pope? Why do we talk about this event called the Tribulation? Why is any of that of any importance to us at all? And that's what I want to talk about today, subject I'd like to explore. Let's review what the Bible tells us about this subject of the end time. Let's see for ourselves why I say I believe we're living in the time of the end. And oftentimes we go to Matthew 24 when we begin to talk about prophecy. We begin to talk about end time events. And so let's not disappoint. Let's start there today, Matthew 24 and in verse 1. Matthew 24 and in verse 1. And it says, Jesus went out, departed from the temple. His disciples came to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus, I'm sure, as he'd done on many different occasions, he's leaving the temple. And when you look at it in the time frame, he's leaving the temple for probably the last time as a human being. And the disciples are around and they're pointing out to him the magnificence of the buildings that are there in the temple area. And if you read any of the descriptions, of course we don't have any pictures or anything, but from the descriptions, the temple, all these buildings that were there were magnificence in their stature, their appearance. The Jews had every right to be proud of what they had. See, the nation was at peace. There was nothing to disturb that magnificence. And so they're pointing out to Christ, you know, look how magnificent, isn't it wonderful how great these buildings are? Notice what Christ says in verse 2. And he said to them, do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone will be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down. And so as he's leaving, you know, and this is almost like an offhand comment. They came up, you know, you almost picture them. They're excited. Look how beautiful it is. And Christ seems to come out of the left field, this offhanded comment. It's going to be destroyed. Verse 3. Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when will these things be and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? So you see here, clearly it got their attention of these disciples. They're pretty rattled. You know, they were trying to say something wonderful, and Christ comes out with a tangent that totally says it's all going to be destroyed. So now they've come to him, what's going on? When is all of this going to happen? But you notice in here, they didn't stop him right away as he's walking away. And yet you have to ask why. But perhaps they felt that, you know, Christ would not give a complete answer if they stopped him right away. There would have been other people around there. And so Christ had gone to the Mount of Olives, and it's, I guess, across from where the temple would have been. They could see clearly the temple, and he's there, and they approach him privately to ask them. So Christ left the temple. He's sitting there, and then they ask him that million-dollar question. You know, excuse me, that comment you said, when and what are these signs? You know, they're rattled. They want to know. You said this was going to happen. They wanted to know then. We still want to know today, don't we? So Christ then gave them the answer, and it goes on in chapter 24 and then on past that. He gives them an answer in his own words. It's a very logical step-by-step procedure. It's called here, we call it the Olivet Prophecy, but it simply means that that's where he was when he delivered this message, that he was on the Mount of Olives. So we see, the first thing we see is the question from the disciples. When is this going to happen? What are the warning signs? How are we going to know? Let's continue on to verse 4. Christ answered, and he said to them, take heed that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not troubled. For all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines, pestilence, earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Notice here the different things he's talking about. He's talking about wars. He's talking about famines. He's talking about different natural disasters. But notice he specifically said these would not be the sign of the end times. Why did he say that? You know, the issue is that these things are not specific enough. All these things had happened and had been happening before Jesus Christ came. You know, and over the 2,000 plus years since he's died, they have happened many times since then. Even Christ doesn't know the exact day of his second coming. But what he did know is that there was going to be a long interval of time before he returned for that second time. You know, when you go through parables, and we've touched on several of those lately, but when you find a parable, you'll see in there how many times it's mentioned that part of the story of a master who goes away for a long period of time. And you see these, and then, you know, as you go through these, you'll see where these, and they'll pop out at you now. These are for future reference. He's talking about a future. So what he was telling him is all of these things that I'm telling you aren't going to happen tomorrow or next week or even in a couple of years. In fact, the signs would take so long that people would then begin to doubt. You know, is it even going to happen? Although wars and famines, natural disasters would greatly increase at the time of the end, they aren't specific to the time of the end. These are events, you know, the war, the famine, the disaster, that are going to happen throughout the intervening years. And that's exactly what's happened through that 2,000-year period of time. But see, they're also going to happen at the time of the end. The difference being is they're going to be on a much larger scale. But you see on here that wars and famines, natural disasters, are not unique to the time of the end. So it still is important not to simply assume that because you see wars and famines and natural disasters that are happening around us today, that they are themselves signs of the end time unfolding. They might be, but we can't assume that. Because, you know, that's what people have done throughout the ages. And the Worldwide Church of God used to do those kind of things. And in so doing, what they did is they sowed seeds of doubt. Everybody gets all fired up. They get all excited. This is going to happen. And then the end doesn't come. And it causes people to doubt. See, the problem is that everybody stopped considering all the other things that had to happen. All the other special conditions that had to be there for these end time prophecies. These things must also be met. As we're going to see, they all have to be met at the same time. And Christ said, as we saw in here in verse 8, all these are the beginning of sorrows. And so we've always interpreted that to mean that these things are going to steadily increase as it gets closer and closer to the end. But that in and of itself shouldn't provide any prophetic detail. As a church, what we do is we look at the different things that are going on around us, and we ask ourselves, are we seeing an escalation of these things? Are they getting more frequent? Are they getting more intense? Are they accelerating? And it's very difficult to call out any one event that may happen and then to claim that, you know, this belongs to the end time. This fulfills this prophecy. It's very hard to do that because you don't know where we are on the scale of intensity. For example, World War I, it was known as the war to end all wars. The war to end all wars. And yet a generation later, you had an even more horrific, more violent war. There are those that have attempted to plug 9/11 into Bible prophecy. I've heard some of these, you know, the things that they say. But you know what? That was 20 years ago now. The end has still not come. And so now, as we continue reading, we come to the next section of prophecy. And as we read through this, notice it gets a bit scary. It's going to get personal. Jesus Christ talks about the persecution of God's faithful. Let's continue on, verses 9 through 14. It says, then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you. Now that doesn't sound pleasant. You will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. Again, not a pleasant thing. And then many will be offended, will betray one another, will hate one another. Then many false prophets will rise up, deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached, and all the world is a witness to all nations, and then the end shall come. Notice the certain words in there. How many times the word then or and is used? See, that implies that things are happening either at the same time or one right after the other, and they're piling on. It also mentions in here the end. So this gives us clues now that we're talking about a very specific event and a very specific time. It's talking about persecution upon the church. So then we have to ask ourselves, you know, that if you look at the history of the church down throughout the ages, throughout history, and we've been able to kind of track where it goes throughout history, you'll find where many times there was an element of persecution. You know, that there were times when they tried to wipe out the entire church. So how is this persecution that it's talking about here, how is that any more a sign of the end than any new war or incidents of famine or perhaps a bad earthquake? How is that any more of an indication? And the answer is because, as it says here, it's on a worldwide scale. It says you will be hated by all nations because of me. So it's talking not about just a localized event, something that is worldwide, all around the world. That hasn't happened. When you look at it, it wasn't really even feasible in the past, and there are two reasons for that. The first reason is you didn't have faithful believers all over the world until more recent modern history. Throughout history, what you have is you have the church that was grouped together, and they would move from place to place, and they would move, and then they would get persecuted, and they would pick up, and they would move again. That's the way the church worked. You know, they eventually went up through Europe. They ended up in England. They came over to the United States. But it's not that way anymore. I mean, half of our church, half of CAGWA members reside outside of the United States. They're scattered all over the world. The second thing we have to notice, in the past, there was always somewhere to run away and hide. The church migrated through Europe, and then when they would get persecuted, they would pick up and they would move. They came to England, then the United States. But on a worldwide scale anymore, there is nowhere to hide. You see, where the church in the past, when they were persecuted, it was localized. It was very periodic in nature. You know, there was a point in time where people would decide this group needs to be punished. Historically, the church had been in hiding. And where you find them throughout history, they're on the fringes. They're on the outside of civilization. But during the persecution at the end time, there will not be any place to hide. Today, for example, we're tracked, we're data mined in everything we do. Every post that you put out on social media is captured. Every item, you know, that you view even. You don't even have to purchase. You can view something on Amazon or Walmart. I mean, recently I was looking for another pair of shoes, and so you're researching what would be a good pair of shoes. Guess what? It seems like everywhere you go, boom, suddenly ads for shoes. They know exactly what I'm looking for. Alexa isn't only listening for a command from you, she's also recording all of your conversations. Your TV is not only smart, but it's listening to you. Your phone knows where you are, knows where you've been, even if it's turned off. Your car knows what you're currently doing. You know, my car, and I find this irritating, you'll be driving along and it'll flash up a little thing that says, driver needs attention, pull over. And you read these things, they have cameras that are watching your eyes as you drive. And if you don't seem to be paying enough attention, it flashes up a message for you. I'm not saying that these things are a sign of the end times. What I'm saying is that technology is now there that hasn't ever been. Technology is there to make it possible for you and I to be found, to be tracked, and it could lead to persecution on a global scale. It's there. Now we see that persecution is tied to preaching of the gospel to the whole world. We just read that. It's now possible in a way that we never could have imagined. If you remember back in the 70s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, the Worldwide Church of God was always on the leading edge of technology. We were on the radio. We were in print. Millions of copies every month. We had hundreds of thousands, if not millions of viewers that watched the broadcast on TV every week. And if you remember, if you go back that far, there were the claims we have been able to reach out to the entire world. Yeah, in a way, but that's nothing compared to what can happen today. Internet access means the truth of God is available to everyone, anywhere, anytime. You can be in the middle of Africa. If you have a phone and have reception, you can catch the gospel message. We couldn't say that in the past. You know, you had to be close to a TV. You had to be close to a radio. It was more than just having a phone. You know, this task of preaching the gospel was something that was appointed to the church. And it says it will be fulfilled before that final worldwide persecution of the church, at the end time. Verse 15 now. Verse 15. He says, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. So that's kind of something that was added in there. Those are not the words of Jesus. But notice here he's referring back to the book of Daniel. He wants us to read, he wants us to understand something from Daniel. So this wasn't supposed to be something new. And in fact, what it is it's kind of an elaboration, a continuation of a prophecy from Daniel that had occurred almost 500 years before Jesus Christ. Daniel mentions the abomination of desolation twice in his book. He mentions it once in Daniel 9 and verse 27, which is at the tail end of the 70 weeks prophecy. I'm not going to go there. I'm going to look at the other one, though. Daniel 11. Daniel 11, and in this section of Scripture, we're talking about the kings of the north and the kings of the south, and I don't want to get into all of that, but what I want to do is kind of jump in the middle here to pick out some information. So verse 31, that's where I want to start. It says, forces shall be mustered by him, this is talking about the king of the north. They shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. This is the verse that Jesus Christ was referring to back in Matthew 24. When he said, go back to Daniel. This is where he was referring back to. Continuing on, verse 32. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many. Yet for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. And when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue. And in verse 35, and some of those who understanding shall fall to refine them, purify them, make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for an appointed time. So in all of this, this is tying back directly to what Jesus Christ was talking about in Matthew 24. We see here, though, that there's more to it than what Christ said. And it's talking about at the same time, is we have this king of the north, and he's going to be overrunning Jerusalem. And we see the people of God being persecuted. Again, you read through here, that does not sound pleasant. And it says these things have to happen at the same time. They're going to happen concurrently. Verse 40. Drop down to verse 40. At the time of the end, gives us our time frame, right? The king of the south shall attack him, the king of the north, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, horsemen, many ships. He shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. So this is talking about, and I'm not going to again get into these events, with the king of the south, it says it's going to attack or push against the king of the north. And that's what's going to cause the king of the north to come down and to invade Jerusalem. So Jerusalem's going to be taken. There are several points that we need to realize in regard to this invasion of Jerusalem. See, the king of the north is going to do certain things while he's at Jerusalem. One thing he's going to do, he's going to outlaw and stop some form of daily sacrifice that's going to be made there. We read that earlier. Instead, he's going to set up something in its place that is an abomination. Abomination to God. The second thing that's going to happen, the invasion is concurrent at the same time as the persecution of the church by all nations. And then we can read here, we'll read here in Daniel 12 and verse 1, it's going to be a time of distress that would be unequaled in human history. We see that in Daniel 12, verse 1. At that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince stands watch over the sons of your people. And there shall be time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. And at that time, your people shall be delivered. For everyone who is found written in, whose name is, everyone who is found written in the book. So just like the disciples, though, you know, when Daniel is here, he's writing all of this stuff. He's being told to write all of these things down. He's also curious. What's going on? When's this going to happen? The very same questions that the disciples had. Notice in verse 7 and 8 here in chapter 12. When Daniel, then I heard the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand to heaven, and swore by him who lives forever that it shall be for a time, times, and half a time. When the power of the holy people has been completely shattered, all these things shall be finished. And although I heard, I did not understand. So what's he do? He asks. And then I said, my Lord, what shall be the end of these things? Now we understand when he talks here about the time, the times, half a time, this is to be a period of 3.5 years. We've always understood that a time is 1 year, times is 2 years, and half a time is a half a year. So 3.5 year period. And that becomes very important as we go through here. So Jerusalem's going to be trampled by the nations for 3.5 years. And you know, that if you're caught up in the middle of it, that's a long time. But if you look at it over the duration of history, it's just a little fraction of time. And what we're going to see is there are several different things that are supposed to happen at the same time, during that time frame. And as we go through here, you'll see that this 3.5 years is also mentioned as 42 months, 1,260 days. So it's all talking about the very same period of time. So when you see these figures, you know, the flag should go up. We need to pay attention. See, it's this period of time that is the key that draws out these specific events of end-time prophecy. It places them all together, helps us to see, helps us to understand. We just saw there in verse 7, it talked about Jerusalem being trampled by the nations for 3.5 years. That links back to what Christ was saying in Matthew 24. Let's look at another one here, Revelation 11. Verses 1 through 3. Revelation 11. Verses 1 through 3. Starting in verse 1, he says, "Then I was given a reed, like a measuring rod, and the angel stood, saying, 'Rise, measure the temple of God, the altar, and those who worship there. But leave out the court, which is outside the temple. Do not measure it, for it has been given to the Gentiles. And they will tread the holy city underfoot for 42 months. So here's that key. The flag should go up, right? It says, "I will give power to my two witnesses. They will prophesy 1,260 days clothed in sackcloth." Again, that key. It's all going to happen at this point in time. Now we're seeing the two witnesses also involved with this. It's used in two different ways here, notice. 42 months, 1,260 days. But it's talking about the exact same period of time. It adds here how during that time frame, it says Jerusalem is going to be under the foot of the Gentiles. Not the Jews, but the Gentiles. Okay, continuing on, looking down through history, and you can see where Jerusalem has been destroyed, been rebuilt many, many times. And that's even since Jesus Christ was here. In AD 70, the Romans destroyed Jerusalem. That's what Christ was referring to when he said no stone would be left on top of one another. And you can read through that. The historian, the Jewish historian Josephus, will tell you that over 1 million Jews were slaughtered. That's a lot of people. That's pretty significant carnage. You know, they didn't have weapons of mass destruction. Over 1 million Jews died, and yet the end did not come. So was the prophecy false? Was it not valid? No, it's not false. That's because when you look at all the past occurrences of the destruction of Jerusalem, what you find is they were missing other elements. It wasn't all there at the same time. None of these invasions happened simultaneously at the same time with the other events, the other conditions that are mentioned in the Bible that are supposed to be prophesied to occur during this 3.5 year time period. You don't find them all together at the same place, at the same time. So we have these three very important events. They have to happen concurrently at the same time, and it has to happen in this span of 3.5 years. It must happen that way in order to fulfill prophecy. Three things have to happen, at least three. One is a great northern power has to invade the Middle East. It has to be focused on Jerusalem to take over Jerusalem. That has to happen. Second thing, a worldwide persecution of the church. The third thing that has to happen, the greatest time of distress in all of man's history. Something that threatens to leave no human alive on this planet. Those three things have to happen all at the same time. So then we have to ask ourselves, you know, whether these three events are more likely, you know, as we logically go through to claim that this is the end time, are they more readily able to happen now than at any time in history? So let's look at each one of those three events to make that determination. The first one is the invasion of Jerusalem. We've already talked about the phrases you'll see that are trampled by the Gentiles, for example. That would indicate that if it's trampled by the Gentiles, they weren't there. They're the ones doing the trampling. That it would have been under the control of the Jews when it was invaded. It's interesting. Only until very recently has there been a Jewish state that's been reestablished and has taken care of Jerusalem? You know, that was not true from the first century when the Romans destroyed Jerusalem until 1948. Almost a period of 2,000 years. That's when the Jewish state was reestablished, 1948. It wasn't until 1967 that they gained control over the entirety of the city of Jerusalem. See, when Rome destroyed Jerusalem in the first century, there were no Jews in Jerusalem in any significant number until 1948. So until 1948, it would not have been possible to take Jerusalem from the Jews. The prophecies speak of this invading king desecrating the temple area. The temple area is now where the Dome of the Rock sits. It's a Muslim holy place. And it says in prophecy, when he does that, he's going to stop some form of sacrifice that has been set up. And in its place, he's going to put something called with some form of abomination. The temple was demolished by Rome some 40 years after the death of Jesus Christ. It hasn't been rebuilt. It's a Muslim shrine at this point. To date, there's been no restoration of the temple area as a place for sacrifice. The Muslims will not allow it. The Dome of the Rock sits there now. That severely complicates things. It's hard to build a temple if there's another sacred building that's already there. See, the circumstances are not fully in place for this great northern king to fulfill this prophecy. This peace is not yet in place. And we're told it has to be there. And it's not at this point in time. See, this is why when you hear people interested in prophecy, they get very excited when you bring up something surrounding the Temple Mount. And you can look, and I've looked online with this, the Jews actually have an altar that has been built. They have built an altar, and they've built it in such a way that it can be taken apart and moved and set back up. They're raising red heifers, and this has to go with, you know, scriptures about the sacrifice. They've created a priesthood. And there's a priesthood over now there now that's training in how to do sacrifices. And it seems like every year you'll hear this, some obscure little news story on the news, and it's usually around the fall holy days, but what you usually hear is that there is a group of Jews that try to go up to the Temple Mount and they want to go and start sacrifices again, but they're stopped. So you see, the parts and pieces are there. They're in play. They've just never been allowed to come together. What will it take? You know, we've seen shifts in this world. It won't take much for all of these things to happen. But until just recently, all those conditions have not been able to be met. That leads another question. Where is the King of the North? We don't have right now at this point in time an obvious king or power of the North. Other prophecies indicate the King of the North is a leader of a coalition, a group of nations. We believe in the Church of God, we have taught for many years that the nations north of Jerusalem, geographically north of Jerusalem, will unite under one power. And that is already in place. It's called the European Union. We know that it's going to be, and it is currently now, a combination of nations from Europe. So it's there. But even though there is this coalition today, it is very strained, and it stays together only with the greatest of difficulty. You know, the latest one was Brexit. Britain pulled out of it. Again, though, the framework is in place. It wouldn't take much, just a certain change in situation, for all of it to come together before our very eyes. It could happen rather quickly. That's why we're told, that's why we watch Europe. We try to understand its politics, try to understand the struggles with the Muslims, anything to do with the Catholic Church. Because all of these things could be important. Let's look at the second area, and that's persecution. The Bible often calls that the tribulation. You know, previously I mentioned a few points about how persecution on a worldwide scale is a lot more possible now than it was, you know, even 20, 30 years ago. Certainly in my lifetime. This global persecution. And so with that in mind, we need to keep our eyes and our ears open. You know, one of the topics that garners a lot of attention these days is hate crime. Boy, that's all over the news, isn't it? Hate crimes against the LGBTQ crowd. Hate crimes against any people of any color. But you rarely hear anything of the largest category of hate crimes that are out there. Look at the statistics. Anti-Semitism. Hatred against the Jews. You'd have thought that had gone away long ago. It is actually the number one hate crime. And it's not just in this country. You find it in Europe as well. Now you combine that with who we know is the God of this world, and we know that he hates the people of God. You can be assured that this hatred is only going to get much worse. But we're not Jewish, right? Although we aren't, you know, to an outraged mob, I would submit to you, I guarantee that anyone who keeps a Sabbath would be considered Jewish. The Jews have been through this enough times. They know that when anti-Semitism increases greatly, it's a sign of something more pervasive. It's a signal of a wider disturbance in a society's soul. And so we should share this awareness of increasing persecution all around us. It may start with the Jews, but we're only half a step removed from that, and it wouldn't take much. Again, the Jews have been persecuted for literally thousands of years. During World War II, more than 6 million Jews were killed by the Germans. It was an attempted genocide. They attempted to get rid of all of them. So what's going to make this time different? It's going to coincide with these other key events that must also come to pass at the same time. You know, and the persecution will probably not start with the churches of God, but it will soon be wrapped up in it, will soon be included in that arena of hatred. And the preaching of the gospel to the world is tied together with that persecution. You know, I don't ever see us giving up preaching the truth unless and until somebody forcibly stops us. And it appears from Scripture that is going to happen. And so that's something else to look for within this time frame. The third area we talked about, this time of great distress. You know, the church has talked about for many years, and I remember it even as a kid, you know, part of that growing up. How many times did you hear how the world is getting worse and worse and worse? And it has been. You know, so what is it that's going to push this world to the point of worse than it's ever been? What's going to push it is that the other parts of the puzzle have to be there, have to be in place. You know, other pieces of the puzzle have happened in the past. There have been kings of the north. There have been rulers over Europe. There have been invasions of the Middle East. But you haven't had all of these pieces come together at the same time. And we're told that another of these elements was a time of distress. It says unequaled in human history. Something so bad that God has to step in and stop it before all life on this planet is destroyed. We commonly turn to Matthew 24. We're not going to do that. But in verse 21, it talks about a great tribulation such as not been since the beginning nor ever shall be. We saw earlier, though, in Daniel 12 and verse 1, this is part of what happens during that 3.5-year period. So Christ uses the passage in Daniel as the basis, as a foundation for what he said in Matthew 24. The difference was Jesus added verse 22. And he said that unless he intervened, all human life would cease to exist. See, in the past, humans didn't possess the ability to destroy all human life. You could kill a lot of people, but the ability to kill everyone at the same time wasn't available. But now we do. Many different ways. You know, since 1945 with the nuclear weapons. Nowadays, though, we have biological, we have chemical warfare. You have all kinds of mechanical things, robots, drones. Mankind is very creative when it comes to killing one another. That's another thing to consider. Think about something else. It's only been in recent times that we've had a world population that is big enough to support a 200 million man army that speaks of in Revelation. And that's just one army. But you have to consider, nowadays China, it's a population of 1.4 billion people. For 200 million man army, you could take one of every seven Chinese to make a 200 million man army. This amazing, this recently developed capacity for destruction appears to be a piece of that puzzle that is now in place in preparation for the end time. But it's not enough. We still need the other pieces at the same time. See, these are the key signs of the time of the end. You know, there's a lot more to prophecy than what we've been talking about here. But to understand when we've reached these end times, these things must happen at the same time. These are the things Christ specifically told his disciples. And then he pointed back to the book of Daniel. And then he fleshes it out some more with additional details in the book of Revelation. Tell them what you're telling them, and then tell them again. There's an emphasis that's being placed here. So do you think it's important? Yes, it is. Can anyone really understand prophecy at this time? As we've been through that, we've seen today, there are certain things that we're looking for. But is that enough for us to understand all of what's going on? Let's go back to Daniel 12 again. Daniel 12, verse 8 and 9. We had read verse 8 earlier. And that is with Daniel questioning. Verse 8, he says, "Although I heard, I did not understand. And I said, My Lord, what shall be the end of these things? And he said, Go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed. When? Till the time of the end." This would indicate that there is going to be additional understanding that is going to be granted at the time of the end. Meaning that the people that are involved in those days will be able to see and understand prophecy, especially the end time prophecy, in a way that people in the past could not. That doesn't mean you know the hour in which Christ comes, but it means you know what to be looking for. Why is that important? Why do we need to know these things? The greater Church of God sees this opening of understanding as a commission to tell, to warn the people of what lies ahead for them. That's part of our commission at the end time. So that they might stop, they might listen, they might think soberly about what's going on. Perhaps repent. That warning has to go out. God always does it that way. And that's part of what the church does even today through the Life, Hope, and Truth website, through the many booklets, through the other tools, the other resources that we have available to us now. There's much more to it than that, but that's part of what we do. But what about you? Put your name in there. What's the point of knowing all of these things? The point is so you don't get misled. Now, that was part of the warning Christ gave multiple times, and you go back and read through Matthew 24. Don't be deceived. He said it over and over again. If we're to be given additional understanding about these prophecies at the end, how are we going to know then that we're not going to be deceived? You know, you've heard it, there are guys out there now. I'm one of the two witnesses. Follow me. How do we know not to be deceived? Christ actually gave us a principle in John 14. John 14, verse 29. John 14 and verse 29. Now he's talking here, this was his last Passover, and he's given them instructions that, and that's what he's talking about, is about him and what's going to happen. But notice it says in verse 29, "And now I have told you before it comes, that when it does come to pass, you may believe." So he told them in advance, this is what's going to happen. They didn't believe it. He did it so that they might prepare themselves for what was to come. To prepare them to get through the doubt that would come. See, at this point in time, it was just a matter of hours before Jesus Christ would be arrested, he would be tried, he would be killed. And it would turn their world upside down. How were they supposed to get through that? As he said here, he says, "I told you in advance this was going to happen." Should give you some comfort. We can relate that very same principle to the end times. We know that there's going to be a foreign power that's going to conquer Jerusalem. We know there's going to be a persecution of the church. We know that the world situation is going to be bad. These things are going to be happening at the same time. So if you hear any quote-unquote new truth, it must expound upon, it must clarify, amplify what we already know. As I said, there are some, even in the Church of God community, that continue to make these outlandish projections. "I've been given insight, follow me." Unfortunately, they aren't based upon what we've already been told. It's some tangent that goes out there in left field. We need to clearly stay away from such promises and predictions. So what's coming is going to be scary. It's going to be threatening. It's going to be life and death dangerous. We've not experienced that. It's going to be bad enough that it's going to be easy to believe, God has lost control of the whole situation. I need to rethink my survival strategy. Perhaps I should just go along with what everyone else is doing. But as Christ said, we've been told what's coming in advance. That should give us comfort. Doesn't mean it's not going to be painful. We should be able to take comfort that God knows what's happening, that He is the one that's in control. He's told us in advance. See, prophecy and its fulfillment is about belief over doubt. This affirmation in God's complete and utter authority over all things. 2 Peter 1, verse 19. Peter says, "And so we have the prophetic word confirmed, which you do well to heed as a light that shines in a dark place, until the day dawns and the morning star rises in your hearts." So we've been warned through prophecy of exactly what's coming. We don't know everything. But what we do know should, as it says here, be like that light, should guide us, should show us a general direction that we need to go. Finally, let's go to Mark 13. Mark 13, verses 32 through 37. Mark 13. Verse 32. "But of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son," Jesus Christ doesn't know, "but only the Father. Take heed, watch, and pray, for you do not know when the time is." It's like a man going to a far country. Again, notice here this analogy. The man going to a far country, left his house, gave authority to his servants, to each his work, and commanded the doorkeepers to watch. Watch therefore, for you do not know when the master of the house is coming, in the evening, at midnight, at the crowing of the rooster, or in the morning, lest coming suddenly he find you sleeping. And what I say to you, I say to all, watch. Notice over and over again, be on guard. Watch. Watch. You know, what we've talked about today has been out there for many, many years. I grew up with this. Some of you grew up as well with this. Hopefully the review today has been helpful for you. But there are many who have just heard bits and pieces and have never understood why the focus on certain things. Are we living in the end time? I would submit to you that the parts are there. The pieces are all in play at this point in time. Simply a matter of time. We need to be ever vigilant, ever prayerful.